In the last 5 years, government spending for military recruitment has more than doubled. And today we spend over $7 billion a year to target potential recruits. This is mostly young people. Military recruiters are on TV, in video games, and at schools across America trying to entice youth into the armed services with promises of money for schools and job training. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is building a secret billion-dollar database of all eligible young recruits, complete with income level, grade point average, and ethnicity. Today, we're discussing the new face of military recruitment, the strategies employed by the government to enlist youth, and the counter-recruitment work being done nationwide by young people and their allies. I'm your host, Anna Sussman, and joining me in the Making Contact studios are Sandra Schwartz, Peace Education Coordinator at the American Friends Service Committee in San Francisco, David Ledesma, Executive Director of the counter-recruitment group One Voice in San Jose, and from Bay Peace, a youth counter-recruitment group in Oakland, California, we're joined by Soti Sechao-Min, a senior at Emiliano Zapata Street Academy. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Great. Let's start by trying to get a clear picture of what military recruitment looks like for young people today. David, let's start with you. You're in the high schools every week, tabling with counter-recruitment materials.
Right.
So tell me, how often are those military recruiters there, and what are they doing?
Well, throughout the Bush administration, they pretty much had free rein to come on campus anytime they wanted to do their work. They would do tabling, offering free goodies for the kids with military branding on them. They would bring military vehicles and chin-up bars and different kind of like game booths to entice these students into talking to them and giving them their contact information and taking information about joining the military. So it's changed a little bit because the military has said that they've met their recruitment goals, which I believe is a complete fabrication. So they don't come on as often, and at least I'm there every week, and they're not there every week that I go, but they could be going different days. But they're on the campuses, and they have free rein to come on pretty much any time they want.
What do you mean that's a fabrication?
Well, it's a known fact that throughout the Bush administration, there was really a failure to meet the recruitment goals. So what they would do is they would lower their standards so that they could bring more recruits into the military. And now, recently, they've been saying that they're meeting their recruitment goals, but I believe it's a fabrication because if you take a look at the war in Iraq, at the highest point, there were something like 180,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, but there were over 200,000 private military contractors. So the military contractors actually outnumbered the number of troops. So if you have to go outside of the U.S. military to go to private contractors, you're not recruiting the number of people that you need to get in the military, and they're still relying on private military contractors to support their efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And Soti, have you seen them come to your school?
They haven't come to my school. Well, the school I'm going to right now, they haven't come to my school yet. But when I was going to Fremont Federation High School, I would see them every day, like during my lunchtime. They would come like at the back entrance of our school where I hang out at, and the recruiters would come and go inside of JROTC and, like, you know, talk to students, or they'll be out there, like, you know, talking to students out in the back while they're having lunch, you know, telling them how interesting the military is and telling them what can they fund the kids that's, you know, just coming in, or, you know, the youth that are coming in, what can they grant you, and all of that, like, information they give you. All of the information they give you, it's like, you know, they're trying to make it like exciting for you to join the military.
And Soti, did you ever talk to those recruiters?
I talked to a Marine. I haven't talked to a military recruiter, but the Marine was talking about the same thing as a recruiter was talking about, of offering me, like, you know, a scholarship for college and all that.
And did you consider joining the military?
There was a point in my life. There was.
What made it appealing to you?
That, like, you know, I thought it was kind of fun of going to, you know, joining the military, like, you know, just seeing and holding a gun and, you know, shooting people is just, like, you know, I thought it was a good thing to do, but, you know, I thought about it again, and I had, you know, I had special help from Babies when I had met up with Babies.
So what made you change your mind?
What made me change my mind was one of my teachers, or not teacher, but like the person who runs Babies, which is Susan Quinlan. And I have, like, if I haven't spoken to her and she haven't given me information about, you know, the military and, like, you know, what's the bad part about it, and if I haven't spoken to her, I would have just, you know, joined the military. Like, if she never gave me no information, you know, about, like, you know, the job experience, you can only use it in the military. You cannot use it on your resumes out here. And, like, they only grant you, like, at least $5,000 when you get out, and they wouldn't grant you no scholarship for college, really. And if I had never heard, like, you know, Susan tell me information about military, I think I would have just joined it and, you know, messed up my whole life.
I just wanted to add that the military recruiter access is really different based on where you live in the Bay Area. So some schools see a lot of military recruiters and other schools see a lot less. And so it really, sometimes it depends on the policy of the school districts, and some school districts are much better about limiting recruiter access. For example, the city of San Francisco says that recruiters are only allowed when they do a career fair, whereas other schools, you know, have recruiters on campus all the time. So, for example, we work in Union City, and they see recruiters on campus once a week at least. You know, it really varies. So I think it's really important for people to realize that school boards do make policy, and they can control recruiter access.
And do we see more recruiters at poorer schools? Does it break down by income level?
Yes.
Yes, it's mostly mainly to Oakland schools. Like, you wouldn't see no recruiters at Piedmont or, you know, under the other cities that, like, are high above, because, like, they target the school districts that are, like, you know, budget cuts, you know, like, that's, like, not having no money. And They're targeting that because, like, they think they can make a change, or they think, you know, they can offer, you know, money, which they really can't, you know, do what they say.
Yeah, one thing I've noticed in the 6 years I've been doing this work is in the more affluent communities like Palo Alto, for example, I've done tabling there a couple times where the school actually invited me to be there on the day the military recruiters were going to be there, and my table was set up right next to theirs. But in a school like that, they will very infrequently go there, because most of those students in an affluent community are going to go to college, and they're really not going to be steered towards the military. Whereas on the east side of San Jose, where I grew up, I mean, they have junior ROTC programs there. They wear military uniforms. The students wear their uniforms. So there is really a concentration of targeting lower-income minority communities.
And also rural communities. I think it's really important to realize that a lot of the recruitment comes from rural communities as well. I think it's really targeting communities where the people who live there have fewer options.
So let's talk about this promise of money for schools. It seems like this is one of the major reasons that youth sign up for the military. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, so there's a difference between what young people are told about money for college and what they actually end up getting. For example, the Montgomery GI Bill provides between $45,000 and $70,000 for college after military, but on average only about $4,000 of that is actually paid out. What's going on there?
From what I've seen, a lot of the money that is promised through the Montgomery GI Bill is based on your rank, is based on the work that you did while you were in the military, is based on your level in the military. So, you know, if you don't have high levels in any of those categories going through the military, then you're not going to get as much money as maxes out to the $45,000. So it's not like everybody gets that amount. It's all based on what you did in the military. If you had some low status job, you're not going to be on the high end.
I think it's also important to realize that there's a new GI Bill, which is much more, it offers a lot more money and a lot more goodies, if you will. but it's only been in effect for 1 year. And so we really don't know how well it's going to work. But what we do know is that people who have served 4 or 5, tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan are frequently experiencing, they're having extreme difficulty returning to civilian life. There's a lot of PTSD, a lot of traumatic brain injury, and just a lot of just people suffering. And so it's really hard for these guys to go back and be on campus with a bunch of 18-year-olds. And so they're older, you know, they're not 18, they're more like 26. A lot of times they've gotten married, they may have kids, they have other responsibilities. And, you know, to go back to a campus and be, you know, in this sort of protected environment that's not very real world isn't very appealing to people who've, you know, been active duty for 8 years or 6 years or 4 years or whatever their contract was. So I think that's a really important part of this whole situation. In the old GI Bill, they had a limited amount of time to use the money. There were a lot of restrictions about how the money was parceled out. And like I said, the new GI Bill has only been in effect for 1 year. So if no one has really been able to do a really thorough study of whether it's going to work or not.
Sandra, I think a lot of those reasons you just mentioned also may speak to why only 15% of military personnel who complete their contract actually get a 4-year degree.
Yeah.
Great. I want to talk a little bit more about recruiting strategies. Do you guys have any stories or know about when a recruiter pursues someone they've identified as a potential recruit? What are some of the things they might do to enlist that person?
Well, one of the things that might be mentioned is how they get in contact with these students in the first place. I mean, the during the Bush administration, there was No Child Left Behind Act, and part of that No Child Left Behind Act was, you know, if schools were going to receive federal money, they had to provide the contact information of every single student in the school, and that was mandatory. You know, the schools could refuse that money. They could refuse to hand over that information, but then they wouldn't get the funding. So I think that's extortion, but that's the way it is. And so military recruiters call kids at their home. I mean, send them emails. And, you know, there's been many times when I've spoken to students said these recruiters keep calling me, and even their parents answer the phone and tell them, quit calling our house. I mean, it's harassment, and they don't give up. So they're relentless with going after these students, and I think that we really need to take into consideration that they're kids. You know, they're 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids, and the military recruiters are like predators. And I think we have predator laws in this country, and to have military recruiters, you know, going after these kids in this way is wrong.
Salty, do you have any friends who've enlisted?
I do. I have one family member that was enlisted. Well, he was thinking about it himself, but like so I guess a recruiter came up to him or something like that. It was my brother. He stays in San Bernardino, and like a recruiter came up to him and like, you know, told him like, because he needed money. My brother needed money, and you know, I guess he was like the recruiter was talking about, you know, how the way to get money from the military and like, you know, everything that you can do, you know, you can make like over, I guess, 50,000 to 70,000. And like, he was interested because, you know, of the money that was coming in, and like, he didn't know what the bad side of the military. And I was like, so I guess he texted me about it. Like, he texted me from where he was at, like, he said, you know, I'm going to, you know, going to go enroll for, you know, do, you know, sign up for the military, sign up for the Army tomorrow. And, you know, and I was like, you know, I think it's a bad choice for you. So I told him everything that I knew about, you know, about like, you know, countering the recruitment for him not to join the military.
And what did he end up doing?
I guess now he actually didn't join. He did not join. So now he's like actually working at a high company job for like video technician and all that, and audio tech.
Great. I'd like to talk a little bit about the strategy of using delayed entry. to sign up young people. This is when a young person can agree to join the military up to a year later, and they have an opt-out, but that's not always told to the young folks. Why is this delayed entry such a successful strategy for signing up young people into the military?
Well, I was interested in that question because, you know, it is really important for young people to know that they can change their mind. And a lot of times military recruiters really threaten them with all kinds of dire consequences if they change their mind. And that's absolutely not true. And if anybody listening to this program has any doubts about that, they should go to www.girightshotline.org. And all of the military regulations are right there for any branch of the military, because basically you can do a number of things, including not show up, but reasons for changing your mind include other. So pretty much if you don't want to go, you don't have to go. So I was interested in the idea that this is a very successful recruitment strategy. And one of the things that I learned is in that period of time when they have signed up, but they're not, they haven't gone to boot camp yet, they do kind of practice military, you know, they go to drills, they learn, you know, different things about military, the kind of more fun things, if you will. So the recruiter is making a relationship with the recruitee. And one of the things that happens is that if the recruitee gives the names, phone numbers, contact information of their friends and colleagues, and if any of those people then subsequently join the military, the enlistee actually gets a promotion. So if they were entering the military as an E1, they can enter as an E2 if any of their friends join the military. So in effect, there's this relationship that is being built between the enlistee and the recruiter that is, you know, securing the enlistee's, you know, guaranteement that they're going to go through with this, and they're potentially recruiting their friends. So, you know, the recruiter has a hard job and is always looking for a hot lead. And this young person can actually provide those hot leads. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why the delayed entry program is successful.
Well, that issue of incentives is pretty interesting. Do you guys know, do recruiters get bonuses based on how many folks they sign up? Do they have quotas that they have to meet? And what happens if they don't meet those?
Yes, like they have to meet their like, you know, the amount that they was served to, like, to recruit. And like if they most, like, I guess what I heard and known is, like, you know, some recruiters that don't make it, like, mostly, like, some really will kill themselves just for, you know, not making their quota, not making their amount that they're supposed to recruit. And like they, I guess it's like a certain amount for them that they can handle, and it's not like, you know, not a given number, like, for them to like, you know, from, I guess, their general or whoever their recruiter is. I mean, they're like, you know, the people above them telling them to, you know, get this amount, get that amount. I think it's like what they can, like, you know, set their goal for, not set their goal, but like set their amount and try to reach it. But I guess when sometimes they don't reach it at all, like, they keep setting it and they can't reach it, it's like, you know, it's more stressful towards them because, you know, I guess their rank is going lower or something like that.
There's actually been a number of articles written about the fact that recruiter suicide rates have really spiked. And it talks a lot about this stress that recruiters are under to make their quotas. And, you know, like Sothi said, if they don't make it, they get a lot of harassment. You know, they may have to work extra hours. And they're also, in the past, recruiters were not necessarily combat veterans. But currently, I think it's 68% of the recruiters are combat veterans. So they may, you know, also be suffering from some additional stress. And that's, I know, I'm guessing that there's some conflict. You know, they actually know what they're recruiting young people to do, based on their experience, and also that they may not be as psychologically able to deal with the stress of recruiting based on their combat experience. I don't know, I'm speculating a little bit there.
David, did you want to add something? So there have been some pretty scary stories out there. Excuse me. There have been some pretty scary stories out there about recruiter harassment, particularly when young people change their mind during this delayed entry period. There's a story of a young woman in the Bronx who changed her mind and allegedly had two military police officers stationed outside her parents' home. One young woman was told that if she didn't go through with her enlistment, her family would be deported. Kids are told that they'll be arrested. They'll be seen as military deserters. Have you guys heard stories of threats like this? David?
Well, last year, I had an experience where a student at one of the high schools joined the DEP program. And it really broke my heart because he was one of the students who used to come to my table all the time and talk to me and real supportive. But they come from a poor community, Alviso, largely minority. And they told him that he was going to get $30,000. So he joined. And when I found out, when the other students told me he joined the National Guard, I was really disappointed. So I immediately went to the iCasualties.org website and I printed out all the names of the National Guard that have died in Iraq. Has over 650 National Guard have died in Iraq. And I took that to the school, the whole list, and I gave it to him. And I said, this is the National Guard who have died in Iraq. And his friends were looking at it and say, his name is going to be on there. And I mean, they were really giving him a hard time because they disagreed with him doing that. But he eventually found out that he wasn't going to get that $30,000 up front. And it was the only reason why he had done that. And so he asked me to help him get out. And so I was so happy to be able to do that. And I said, all you got to do is tell him you don't want to come back and don't go. You don't have to show up. You know, it's a non-binding contract. So that's what he did. He told his recruiter he wasn't interested anymore. And they said, well, if you're going to leave, that you have to come to and talk to my commanding officer. So, you know, for like an exit interview. And I told him, look, that you know, they're going to sit you down and they're going to try their hardest to get you to stay in. I said, but you need to be strong and you need to, you know, stand your ground and say no. And he did it. So there was pressure put on him as far as telling him that he had to come in for this like exit interview with the commanding officer, but he was strong enough to tell them, no, I don't want to be a part of this anymore.
Sandra?
You know, we are one of the places where the GI Rights Hotline, the GI Rights Hotline is a hotline that's national, and there's 20 different locations where the calls are taken, and we're one of those places. So we get a lot of DEP calls. And, you know, we hear a lot of stories. There is a tremendous amount of pressure put on these kids. It's really important for them to know that that's kind of a standard line, that they have to go in and have an exit interview or just, you know, some kind of a process. That's not true. They don't have to do that. What we say is that if you start to get a lot of pressure and you don't like it, you can always shut off your phone. Just don't take the calls. You know, sometimes a recruiter will call the parents. You know, they don't have to take the calls. It's, you know, the stories about the pressure on DEP cases are extraordinary. You know, there are stories of kidnapping, really off-the-wall stuff. I tend to think that those things are exceptional, but it is standard that there is extraordinary pressure on the kids to follow through with that contract, and they really need to know that they don't have to. And if there is abuse, there is a phone number. It's 1-877-688-6881 to report recruiter abuse. And, you know, what we're trying to do is document enough cases that there could be congressional hearings or, you know, media, some way of continuing to bring light on this issue of recruiter abuse.
Do you guys in your counter-recruitment work ever face harassment or threats?
In the beginning, when I first started doing this work, I was approached by recruiters. You know, we'd be setting up our tables on the same day, and you know, out of curiosity, I guess they would come over to me and ask me what I was doing. And once I told them, I mean, my opening line is, "Well, I'm here to talk to students about their plan after high school and not to join the military." I'm very open about it, and they get very upset. And I got into a shouting match with one Marine who was challenging me. And he soon found out that he was challenging the wrong person because I deal with facts and not fiction. And so he couldn't defend any of his argument. And, you know, there must have been 50 students around our tables listening to us. And he finally got frustrated and went off. And one of the students turned to me and says, you know, what is this all about? And I said, well, he wants you to join the military, you know, and he wants you to go kill people. That's what this is all about. So in the 6 years I've been doing this, they all know who I am, and they avoid me now. They used to come over and be real cordial and polite and shake my hand, and now they don't come over at all because they know that I'm not going to stray from my message, and there's nothing they're going to be able to do or say that's going to change that.
And we should mention that a lawsuit about 25 years ago guarantees counter-recruiters the same access to schools that military recruiters have. But David, I wanted to follow up with you. This work is pretty personal to you. What made you start doing counter-recruitment?
Well, back in May 20th, 1967, my oldest brother was killed in combat in Vietnam. He was 20 years old, drafted out of college into the Army, and less than a year later, he was dead. I was 13 years old, and I didn't talk about his death for 36 years until the Iraq War came about, and all these years later, I knew that I had to do something about recruiting into the military to go kill people. And so right before the Iraq invasion, I got involved with a local peace organization in the South Bay, and I went to the very first protest I'd ever been to in my life. I'd never done anything like that, but I was determined to be a part of the peace movement. And so it's personal in that sense that luckily one of the schools that I do weekly counter-recruiting on is my brother's alma mater. So I'm very happy to be on campus there. And I have displays, I have handouts and things on my table. And one of the displays is a 20-inch by 30-inch enlarged picture of my brother in Vietnam. And when the students come up to the table, I say, this is my brother. And that's what happened to him. And I don't want that to happen to you. And I don't want anybody you know that to happen to. So it's personal in that way. And being a Gold Star brother, I can let them know what it's like. And the students are very receptive to that image. They really are. I mean, that really hits them. It's not just any old photograph. That's my brother. And then they listen. And it's been a really good experience over the last 6 years to be going on the campuses and talking to the students and telling my story and letting them know basically that I care about them. I care about you, and I want you to be safe. I want you to be with your family.
Great. Thank you so much. One of the things the Pentagon uses in youth recruitment is something called the Joint Advertising Market Research and Studies Database. It's a very long and complicated term for what seems to be a list of young people that they can identify for recruitment. So, can you tell us a little bit more about that list?
I think, yeah, they're talking about jammers, right?
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, it's jammers. Called jammers.
Yeah, jammers. They would, I guess they get all the information from, like, I guess schools, shopping, like, you know, your credit card while you're shopping, you know, I guess, socializing, like, you know, email, you know, emailing, you know, internet, you know, when you sign up for Facebook or MySpace, you know, social stuff that you would do. But, you know, it's, that's how they get, you know, all your information. They get all your information, then they will come up to you and, or contact you by any way. And, you know, talk to you about all this, you know, military stuff. And, you know, you're wondering, like, you know, wow, how did they get my information? You know, like I said, like colleges, I guess they sell their information to jammers. Hmm. And jammers give it to the military to come recruit us youth. I guess that's what, like, jammers all about.
So can you describe the Bay Peace opt-out victory that you guys recently won here in Oakland?
Yes, I can. what we've been working on for 2 years was, I think since 2008 or 2008, that we were trying to, like, stop jammers from getting youth information from our schools, from, like, you know, SATs, PSATs, you know, taking tests that are giving information. And, you know, and, like, we've been working on, like, I guess, putting a opt-out form in our Oakland Unified School District. What is it called? Thingy form?
Opt-out.
No, it's an opt-out form that's putting in their registration form. Mm-hmm. That's attached to the registration form. So when they register for school, they have the rights to opt out there and then while they're registering for school.
So now that opt-out form comes automatic with their school registration forms?
Yes, it comes right in their registration packet.
Great. And what was your experience in working on this campaign? What did you find was difficult, and what did you find was really inspiring?
What I found was difficult was when trying to get over, I guess, 1,000 signatures. 1,000 signatures. And, like, you know, it was kind of, like, hard because, you know, you'll go up to, you know, the public. You're going to the public and asking them, you know, hey, you know, can you help us sign our, you know, youth manifesto form, or Bay Peace youth manifesto for, like, you know, to pass our resolution. And, like, it's hard going up to, like, the public and asking them, like, because you don't even know them and they don't even know you, and you're asking them to sign something. And, like, it was kind of, like, you know, scary and hard because they would say, you know, they would say no, but, you know, you got to take no as an answer. And, like, you know, they would say, you know, what is this for? And you would have to talk and conversate with them. They'd be like, no, this and that, no this, no that. And some would say yes, you know, most would say yes. And it would be a good thing, like, you know, if we tell them, you know, what are we doing, you know, like, we're trying to help youth out from, you know, going into the military, getting recruited from the military. And they'd be like, oh, okay, you know, is there any way that I can contact you guys? And, you know, we give them our contact information, and, you know, to email us about more of this, you know, more just, like, you know, like, information of what they're asking for.
So, Sothi, why did you want to work on this? Why was it important to you? Why did you even care if some kids' names were on a list?
To help save a life. That's what's mainly I'm thinking about, is to help save a life of another person instead of, you know, getting more, you know, deaths in our world. We need to have more people in our world.
Great. So what's next for Bay Peace? What are you guys working on next?
What are we working on next? I guess we're working on, we're getting our word out, our resolution out. We're trying to have, like, you know, every school district. Well, I think Berkeley Unified School District just passed the resolution for the same thing as ours. And we're trying to get, San Francisco Unified School District to do the same. And so we're going to go, like, to different school districts and let people know what we accomplished and, you know, what we do and what Bay Peace is about. So they'll get an understanding, you know, they'll think again, like, hey, you know, let's do something like that. Let's accomplish something, you know, that's positive. And maybe, you know, maybe it's like, it's like we're helping, you know, we're helping, like, a whole bunch of people that's, you know, that's in need.
I just wanted to comment, as a partner organization with Bay Peace on the campaign, it was really extraordinary. I mean, these guys put together a rally that brought in, I don't know, probably at least 1,000 youth from the Oakland. And it was spoken word. They put on a play. They did a military fashion show. They went to the school board and testified. They did a play at the school board meeting. You know, it was just really energizing. And I think it was also incredibly empowering of all of the youth that worked on this campaign, because they saw, you know, the fruits of their labor, and that the district actually passed the resolution.
Great. Sandra, tell me what kind of work you guys are doing now.
Well, the AFSC at the moment in the Bay Area is serving as a umbrella organization for a coalition of groups that do counter-recruitment work, and it's called Full Picture. And what we do is, initially, we realized that there were all these groups out there that were doing counter-recruitment work, but a lot of times one group didn't realize that another group was doing the same work, and sometimes they were working in the same school without even knowing that, you know, two different groups were working there, and, you know, they're kind of stepping on, they weren't necessarily stepping on each other's toes, but wasn't necessarily as efficient as it might have been. So what we've done is everybody's kind of working together, and we're coordinating our work. So, you know, we know where Bay Peace is working. We work a lot with the Grandmothers Against War. They're one of our biggest partner organizations. And we've worked with David a little bit in terms of doing some training. But pretty much what we have is we have resources, we have tabling kits, we have speakers and a speakers bureau, and we're working. We have active activities happening in 24 schools, and then there are additional schools with partner organizations that are not as clearly identified with Full Picture. And we have we're working at a number of community colleges. City College has just said that they really want to take this on, and so they're going to have materials at all 10 campuses. So it's exciting, and it's really just kind of coordinating the work and empowering lots of people to do it. And we always, always need more volunteers. I mean, currently, the Bay Area has in the top 100 counties of the highest enlistment rates. Bay Area counties are on that list. So Alameda County is on there, Contra Costa County is on there. Solano County is the highest recruited county in the Bay Area. San Joaquin. So we need more folks coming from Oakley, Brentwood, Antioch, Livermore, Vallejo, Benicia, you know, wherever. And we, you know, basically, we're not going to boss you around. We're going to just try to help people who are worried about this issue, give them materials, give them, you know, ideas, give them support, and have people out there in the schools working to let kids know the full picture, you know. But the recruiters are going to tell them one side of the story. We want to make sure that they have the other side of the story. And that's actually been our experience with working with school districts, is that that's an argument that educators can really relate to, that young people deserve to hear the, you know, the full, all side of the argument, both sides of the argument, I mean, all sides of any issue. And so when you present your case from that point of view, a lot of times administrators and school personnel will say, yes, you can come in and table. Yes, you can do this.
Go ahead. Did you want to say something? Did you want to remind her something? You can jump in. Okay. It seems like one of the big issues right now is the DREAM Act and educating folks around the implications of the DREAM Act. What is it that people need to know about the DREAM Act? David?
Well, I think what people need to know about the DREAM Act is that it is not only about education, that there is a military component to the DREAM Act. And a few years ago, when I first heard of the DREAM Act, I was curious. I thought this is a great issue, you know, providing education for immigrants. And when I began reading and doing my research, I saw that there was a military component. And I thought, my God, you know, this bipartisan legislation has actually found a way to encourage the Latino community to support military recruiting their own kids. And I couldn't believe it. And, you know, this is a very smart strategy on their part that, you know, we don't have a military draft in this country, and that we, they call it an all-volunteer army, but really there are military, but it's really a poverty draft right now. There's a poverty draft in America where the largest concentration of people going into the military from poor and minority communities. That's where they're coming from. And so the DREAM Act really has to be looked at in a deeper way. And I oppose the DREAM Act because it has this military component in it. I don't oppose providing educational opportunities and citizenship for Latinos, but I do oppose the military component. It's very dangerous.
Well, a lot of activists think a way to eliminate the poverty draft is to institute a universal draft, because then all Americans would be sending their children to war, and only then would you get real objection to militarism. What do you guys think? Do you think a draft would be more fair?
I don't think so. I mean, my brother was drafted. You know, he was going to college, and he got drafted, and less than a year later, he was dead. So I have heard some activists say that we need the draft so that everybody, you know, kind of has a stake in the situation and will wake up to what's going on. But, you know, I think that if you take a look at during Vietnam, you know, George Bush is a perfect example. You know, he was coming up for the draft, so his father got him in the Air National Guard. And at that time, the Air National Guard was considered the Champagne Division of the National Guard, because you weren't going to Vietnam. you know, you were in the Air National Guard during Vietnam. You were going to fly antiquated airplanes that they didn't use in Vietnam. So you were going to be stateside. So if you're rich and you're connected, you're not going to have the combat duty. You're not going to be going overseas and fighting. You're going to have some cushy little job somewhere stateside. And so it's not going to be fair. It's never fair. And we shouldn't look at bringing back the draft as a solution.
I would say we need to look at whether our military has accomplished anything. I mean, I think if you look at these last, I think if you look at war in general, you could say that there's many, it has not accomplished what we wanted, but especially in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's very clear that war is not the answer. And so, you know, we would be much better off to be using the trillions of dollars that we've spent on these two wars to, for our own people and for development and aid in those in around the world, and we would have less need for war.
Salty, you seem to have a strong reaction when I brought up the idea of bringing back a draft.
I mean, for the drafting, it's I don't know what to say. I'm just having lost.
All right, that's fine. I wanted to ask you guys about how Don't Ask, Don't Tell affects youth recruitment. Do you know of any story? I know a lot of schools say that Don't Ask, Don't Tell violates their non-discrimination policies, but again, they're threatened with the loss of federal funding if they ban recruiters. Do you guys know any instances of recruiters recruiting gay and lesbian youth and telling them to stay quiet, or have you seen any intersection with recruitment and Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
No,
me. I heard a whole bunch about it, but like I never seen it happen in action. I never, like, you know, heard from anybody that told me. I mean, I heard people tell me that, you know, in the military you can't be gay, you can't be lesbian. If you are, you know, keep it on the down low. Don't let nobody else know. Only it's in between them, the person that's, you know, gay or lesbian, and the person that's interviewing or talking to them.
I think the only place where I've, you know, sort of seen this as a discrimination issue is that, and this came up around the JROTC campaign in San Francisco, that the, you know, youth who are gay and openly gay and lesbian can be in JROTC, and they're saying, so it's not, you know, an issue because we have gay youth, openly gay youth in JROTC. But the fact of the matter is that you can't be openly gay in the military, and so one of the quote-unquote benefits of JROTC is that if you then go and join the military, you enter the military at a higher rank. You enter it, as I said, as an E2 or an E3. So that quote-unquote benefit is not actually available for youth who are openly gay and lesbian and participating in JROTC, nor are they eligible for any of the scholarships. You know, JROTC cadets are eligible potentially for ROTC scholarships as well as to the various military academies. So, you know, it's kind of like once removed kind of discrimination, but it's still there. I think that this issue is really complicated because, you know, it for people who want to get out of the military, it has been an option. They could, you know, if they were gay or lesbian, they could out themselves and they would be, you know, what's the word I want to say? Released. That's not the right word, but anyway. And, you know, a lot of gay rights activists, you know, obviously we don't want discrimination, but it's been an out. And so it's like one of those things where you can't support discrimination. But for those who could get out of the military based on the fact that they were lesbian or gay, it's a door that's shutting.
Well, I'd just like to add to that, you know, I support gay marriage. I have no problem with that. But I really have a problem with repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because I don't want anybody to join the military and kill people. I don't care if you're straight or if you're gay. I don't want you going in the military and being sent overseas to kill people. So it's a tough issue, and it's an issue that I don't think I haven't heard anybody else talking about, but I don't support the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because that's a green light for the military to go after gay and lesbian people, to fight in their wars, their imperialist wars around the world, and I don't support that. It's the same thing with the DREAM Act. You pass the DREAM Act, and you're going to have a green light to start recruiting the Latinos into the military to go fight these wars that are not in their interest.
And I'd like to add to the DREAM Act part of it is that we're talking about a huge number of potential recruits. It's like 2.1 million young Latino undocumented youth. So, I mean, they're not necessarily all Latino, but undocumented youth. And of those youth, the vast majority of them are not going to be able to get on the pathway to citizenship through going to college because they don't have other kinds of support. So one of the things that happened in the years that the DREAM Act has been going along is that they've stripped out all of the things that were alternative ways for young people to be able to get on a pathway to citizenship. They took out the Pell Grants. They took out the community service. The California DREAM Act was actually passed, and it included in-state tuition support and Pell Grants and you know, other good things, and Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed it. So, you know, I think that the bottom line of the DREAM Act is that we really want to support the DREAMers who are working so hard for this opportunity, but we have to be really cognizant of the fact that the vast majority of kids are not, they're just, as David said, they're going to be prime targets for military recruitment because it's the only way they'll have to get on a pathway to citizenship. And then you have to remember, it's only provisional. It's a provisional path to citizenship.
I think another consideration that isn't being discussed is, you know, during the Vietnam War, our troops didn't understand the language or the culture of the Vietnamese people. And during the current occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, our troops don't understand the language or the culture of those people. But you start recruiting large numbers of Latinos into the military, you know, there's going to be some future action in South America. You know, you've got leftist or progressive democratically elected governments in South America, in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in other countries. And what a perfect scenario to have all these Latinos into the military, and they understand the language and the culture of the people down there. So the military is going to be in a good position to be able to fight wars down there to stop democracy.
That's a really interesting point. We are wrapping up here, so I want to let you know that you'll be released from your sauna shortly. I'm sorry if it's boiling in there. Salty, I wanted to ask you, as a high school student, what do you think is most effective in counter-recruitment? What really gets kids' attention when they're thinking of enlisting?
I mean, what do you mean, like, as in helping them get out, or?
Yeah, like, what makes them change their mind? What makes them think twice when they're really eager to enlist because they get money for school and they'll get job training? What do you think you say to them that really makes them stop and maybe turn around?
I always tell them, the people that I know, I always tell them, you know, are you going to listen to me, or are you going to listen to some random guy that came up to you that's from the military and telling you all this, you know, BS? That's like telling you all this BS that's, you know, that's not a fact. That's like, you know, that's not even going to help you in life. And, or like, you know, or you'd rather listen to your own friend that, you know, or your own person that, you know, that you knew for, like, what, years now? And, like, you know, like, give them a scale, like, you know, give them a scale, think about, you know, and talk to them that, and tell them that, you know, what's bad about the military. Talk to them, you know, how they're not going to grant you for your $45,000, $50,000. It's, like, only $4,000 coming out, $5,000 coming out of there. And, you know, and I would tell them, what if you don't make it out of there, you know? What if you get in combat the first or second day you get there? And what if you go into combat already and you signed up for it? And they could change your jobs and all that. And, you know, without a hassle, they could just change your, you know, job that you signed up for. And, like, you know, what if you just went into combat, into the killing fields, into the field, you know, where mines and stuff at? Or, you know, what if you step on a mine? You know, I would tell them, like, the bad things about it. And, you know, I would tell them, look, you know, go to college, you know, fight for your education. Do not do none of this because, you know, it's a lot of bullshit. I mean, BS, you know, you'll come back traumatized, or, you know, you'll come back just crazy, or you come back with nowhere to live and, you know, your family are gone, you have no contact with them.
So you think hearing from other young people is a great way to get kids' attention?
Yeah, I mean, hearing from other young youths about, like, you know, about the military or what's bad about it. It makes me happy to hear, like, you know, they don't want to join anymore, or what, like, the information I give them, you know, it makes me happy for when they come back to me and, you know, tell me that, you know, thanks for helping me out, or, you know, like, you know, I wish I can be a person like you, you know, helping out everybody and, you know, giving information towards other youth about not joining the military.
Great. David, you mentioned that your brother's picture was really effective, but you're in those schools once a week, twice a week?
Every week.
Every week. What else do you find is really effective in counter-recruitment work?
Well, I think just being present there and providing an alternative voice about the military and how the military is used in the United States. And Sandra mentioned something earlier about being on campus to provide information so that students can make a more informed decision. That's what it's about. I mean, I'm in no position to take on the military and their, you know, being on campus. You know, that's a big lawsuit, a lot of attorney fees that I just could not afford to do. So at least being on campus and providing alternative message. When I was in high school at the height of the Vietnam War, you know, 67 to 71, and there was a culture of peace on campus. I mean, everybody was against the war, just about. And there was just this culture among young people at that time against war and for peace. And so at least what I'm trying to do now is to try to instill that culture, because these students are not going to hear this message anywhere else, believe me. I give away free peace-oriented buttons and free peace necklaces and free little mini stickers with peace messages, anti-war messages on there. And, you know, that's what the military does. And, you know, the students, they eat that stuff. Anything that's free, they're going to go after. But at least, you know, these are buttons and stickers and necklaces that they wear. I mean, they collect them and they put them on their backpacks and they put them in their lockers. They take them into their community. So they're like a walking billboard for the message. So being on campus on a weekly basis, I mean, even today, I was supposed to be at one high school, and I know next week they're going to say, where were you? You weren't here last week. That's happened in the past, and that's great to hear that feedback from them. So to be there on a regular, consistent basis, providing the information that I provide to help spread this culture of peace on campus with students is it was a wonderful thing.
And Sandra, what do you find most effective in your work?
Well, everything that people have said, I really don't think you can underemphasize or over. You can't overemphasize the need to build relationships. And I think, you know, we can see this in the studio with Sophie. You know, the young people are wonderful. And I think for the most part, you know, their hearts are right there to be touched. And so having people there who care makes a big difference. But in addition, we have found that veteran stories, veteran presentations are really effective. You know, and a lot of times people want current veterans, but, you know, we've also found that Vietnam veterans and, you know, older veterans are also have important stories to tell that youth really respond to. A couple of years ago, we partnered with Bay Peace, and we did a road trip with half of the youth being what we were calling military positive, meaning that some of them were coming out of military academies, but they intended to join the military when they got out of high school, and half the youth being youth activists. And, you know, we took them on this trip for a week, and we took them, basically, we gave them as many exposures as possible. You know, we went to Swords to Plowshares facilities, we talked to veterans groups, we went to Camp Pendleton, we did all these different things. And when I would watch the youth, I noticed that often, and their comments afterwards, where they were really touched by hearing the stories of families. A lot of kids would say, I don't want to do that to my mom. I don't want my mom to worry about me like that. So I think that all of us have a role to play. You know, we can all be effective counter-recruiters. If we care about youth and we want to create a better society, there's a role for us to play. And the people who have children or young people in the military have a really important role to play. Gold Star families have an important role to play. Veterans have an important role to play. But it's for all of us to really look out for our young people.
Great. And I want to mention again that counter-recruiters are allowed the same access by law to schools that recruiters are allowed. What can listeners do to educate themselves and their children about youth recruitment? If there's something you could tell them, what would it be?
Can I just comment about that equal access issue? You know, that's actually used often to say that they can't restrict recruiters, and they should know that, you know, college recruiters are not on campus every day or even once a week. They usually schedule one visit a year. And now, with all the budget cuts, California recruiters, you know, college recruiters are not coming to campuses at all. So school districts have the right to limit military recruitment. They don't have to give them unlimited access. Another thing that's really different is that a college recruiter signs up in advance. Students are released to go and hear, you know, speak to that recruiter. They don't have free rein to walk around campus, set up, you know, obstacle courses, bring in their little frisbees, you know, whatever. You know, it's a very contained situation. So families should know that they have rights and that military recruiters don't have a right to unlimited access. That's one thing.
Just to be clear, that law says that schools have to give the same access to military recruiters that they give to college recruiters. So if they limit the amount of access college recruiters get, they can do the same for military recruiters. Great. So let's get to some final thoughts. David, what do you want people to know that maybe we haven't touched on yet?
Well, I think that people need to realize that our youth are at risk because you know, the military is going after them, and the reason they're going after them is because, you know, we're continuing two illegal occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they need people to go fight. And they're going to go after these young people to do that. They're having budget cuts. They're cutting back on education. There's unemployment is an all-time high. There's poverty wages out there. And we need to protect our young people. And the best way is to invest in them. And we need to take a look at where are taxpayer dollars being spent. 48% of the federal budget is Pentagon related. And I know people from other countries, Ireland and Great Britain and South Africa and Australia, and they think it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous that 48% of our federal budget is Pentagon related. And you're cutting back education, people are losing their homes, and what kind of future is there for our young people? There's a military future, and the American public needs to get really pissed off about that. They need to get really upset and take a look at where is the funding going? Where is it really going? In Washington, D.C., they're the ones that are controlling shots. Washington and their corporate stakeholders, and the ones who are suffering are what I feel they consider the throwaway kids. They're just throwaways. They're troublemakers. They get in trouble. They're not going to make anything out of themselves. So throw them in the military. Teach them some discipline. That's the wrong way to go about it. The best way to save our youth is to invest in them. And the best way to invest in them is not by raising taxes, is by using the money that we already have in this country and spending it on the Pentagon and cutting that budget so that we can provide for the needs of all our people.
Salty?
My final thought is that there is always a way to opt out, you know, from the military, that you can always go online and you can always go to baypeace.org. We also have a opt-out form on there, so you can print it out and, you know, fill it out and send it into the address that is given on there. And, you know, like, for teens and youth that are listening out there, like, imagine, you know, you losing your family off of this military stuff. Imagine yourself losing a leg. Imagine yourself losing an arm or losing, you know, stepping on a mine that is from your own, you know, your own, like, teammates. You know, you accidentally step on a mine and, you know, you just kill yourself. Think about all the hard stuff that, you know, that can happen, you know, before you even join. You know, think about it. Like, take a second. I mean, take however long and think about all that. It's like, you know, the bad, violent things that can happen.
Well, I agree, and I also think that people should also realize that it's hard to live with yourself after you've participated in these acts of violence. And so, you know, we're seeing extraordinary rates of suicide of veterans, 18 a day, according to the Department of Defense. I really agree with David about people really looking at these issues. I mean, there's like the surface issue that too many kids are being recruited, that there's this billions of dollar budget to recruit kids, But it is part of this bigger package where, you know, the U.S. Spends more than the rest of the world combined on our military. We have basically one hammer for all situations, and that is a military hammer. And we need to be much more sophisticated. We need to really, we need to be citizens of the world instead of police of the world. So I think that's another issue. I think about these databases like Jammers and even the No Child Left Behind. There are fundamental issues around privacy. And there are 35 million young people in that database, you know, between the ages of 16 and 25. To me, that feels a little bit like Big Brother. I mean, they have all this information. They know their name, their address, their phone number, their email, their ethnicity, their grade point average, their intentions for the future, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of creepy. And I think that no matter what you think about the military, you might want to be concerned about the fact that the military is not the military. Well, the Pentagon is controlling this information, but the government is collecting it. So, you know, there are lots and lots of ways that people need to think about this issue. If you're concerned, get involved. There's lots of ways to get involved. You can call me at the American Friends Service Committee. You can call Bay Peace. You can call David. But get involved, because they have billions of dollars. We have hundreds of dollars. And yet, so the way we are effective is if we have people who work with us.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being here and for sharing your thoughts and views. Sandra Schwartz from the American Friends Service Committee, David Ledesma from One Voice in San Jose, and Sokthi Sechaumin from Bay Peace in Oakland. We will link to all of their websites from our website, radioproject.org. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.